know the why human trafficking work is needed. To fight for the freedom of modern-day slaves. But love, passion, commitment isn't all you need to be an effective and successful anti-trafficking advocate. Learn the how. I'm Dr. Celia Williamson, Director of the Human Trafficking and Social Justice Institute at the University of Toledo. Welcome to the Emancipation Nation podcast, where I'll provide you with the latest and best methods, policy, and practice discussed by experienced experts in the field so that you can cut through the noise, save time, and be about the work of saving lives.
Hey, Lisa, how's it going?
Not good.
Why?
DMX died. Is that okay?
Oh, I know. Stop. Drop.
Hey.
Shut him down. Open up shop.
Oh, that's how rough riders roll. You know, a little tribute. Gotta give respect.
Or a little liquor for DMX. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I remember we were doing a three-part series.
Yes. So we were talking last week about the Federal Family First Initiative. And last week we talked about some federal laws, but that was the main one. And that law really greatly affects how states will respond to youth who are trafficked or at risk for trafficking, particularly youth involved in any form of out-of-home placement, whether it's family foster care, group homes, residential care. So if you missed last week's episode, go back and listen to that because this week builds on that.
Yep. And last week we had Sarah Ladd and Bethany Gilo talking about that. And they're back again this week. Yes.
Yes. And they brought a friend named Heather Baker, who provides some really good insight into the conversation. So like last week, we focused on the federal law. This week, we're going to focus in on what it means for states. And depending on what the states do and how they interpret the federal law is really going to greatly affect people and programs that offer housing to trafficked and at-risk youth, and then ultimately the type of care that youth receive. So it's an important episode. It's an informative episode. So without further ado, my interview with Sarah, Bethany, and Heather. Welcome back to the Emancipation Nation podcast. We have a three-part series. So last week, we talked about federal laws related to human trafficking, and we sort of hinted and talked a little about Family First, but in this episode, we really want to drill down into Family First, that Family First Prevention Services Act, and sort of what that means. And you know, there's a lot of urgency specifically for residential care, foster care, those types of things, because they have to get their act together and some things in place by October 1st. So we want to talk about that, what that is, what that means, what the standards are, sort of how people can start to provide more quality services. So we brought back Bethany Gilo. Is it Gilo?
Gilo.
Okay. So we brought back Bethany, who's the National Consultant on Anti-Trafficking Policy and Practice. We brought back Sarah Ladd. She's the Minnesota Department of Human Services Human Trafficking Child Protection Program Coordinator. And we also have Heather Baker, and she works for Public Consulting Group. And they really consult with child welfare state agencies, and they make sure that child welfare agencies are complying with federal laws, having better outcomes, and those types of things. If you all never knew that, that's how it all happens. I did not know that. But they come alongside states and they say, this is how you do it well, and how you follow the protocols, and how you are compliant, and how about some good outcomes, and all those things. So these are sort of three powerhouse women who are going to explain to us a lot more about Family First, and something I think is going to be interesting that we're all going to really need to learn a lot more about. So welcome, powerful women.
Thank you.
Yeah. So tell us a little more about Family First. I'm going to just start off perhaps with Sarah. She's the lawyer in the house. So tell us a little more about Family First.
Sure. And I can take a first crack at it. And then I know Heather maybe has been involved kind of historically on a bit more of how Family First came into being and so forth. But nutshell is that the Family First Prevention Services Act was signed into law in January of 2018. And it really is the spirit of this law is to try and help keep children in their communities and at home. And so it does a couple of different things. It tries to provide, it takes some federal money that is called the Title IV funds is sort of how people refer to it. And it changes the way that it's used. So it does that there, and there's lots of things that happen in this law, but I'll just highlight the two main buttons. One is, which is not the thing we're gonna talk about today. One is the creation of prevention, placement prevention services that can now be funded using these federal dollars that previously only could provide money for to pay for out-of-home placements for the most part. That's what the dollars were for. And now they can also be used to prevent out-of-home placements. And then the other big bucket of things that this does is it actually makes it harder to put kids into group or congregate out-of-home placement settings. Generally speaking, this law is trying to do. So it creates these new types. Creates basically new requirements for congregate or group placement settings. And in order, if they want to get funded with these federal dollars through their local child welfare agencies, then they need to comply by becoming, by following their state's new rules to become one of these specific types of settings. So there are four setting types that are the general rule now is that group placements would have to be qualified residential treatment programs, meeting a whole list of process requirements and standards for the facilities themselves. Then there are a few exceptions to that standard. They are, one is the exception that we're going to talk about today, which is for settings who are specializing in providing high quality residential care and supportive services for children and youth who have been victims of sex trafficking or who are at risk for sex trafficking. Then there also are exception settings for specialized care for pregnant or parenting youth, or for youth who are in independent living or kind of transitional setting for youth who are a little bit older. And so we are really focused on that exception type, that specific specialized setting for youth who are at risk for sex trafficking or who have been sex trafficked. And that's kind of the overall picture for Family First. Heather or Bethany, do you want to jump in and add a little more to that?
Sure. I think to get to the objectives, there's a lot of research that would indicate that family-like settings are the best for children. And so, primarily the best kind of placement for a child who can't stay safely in their own home is in the home of kin or, you know, a family member or someone close to the family. That's the most successful setting for kids by and large in the aggregate. And then in family-like settings, so a foster family setting, those are the two types of settings that Family First is trying to encourage. And so by creating these additional requirements around any non-family-like settings, the federal government is trying to make sure that those types of settings are specifically designed to meet the needs of the children who are placed there. For the settings that we're going to focus on today, it's interesting because the qualified residential treatment program that Sarah mentioned, the law is very detailed in the requirements for those kinds of programs. But for high quality residential care and support services for children at risk of trafficking or who have experienced trafficking, that's all the law says. It has no further requirement. And so states are now working to figure out what does that mean for them? What kinds of standards will they set? What are their expectations for providers who are designing those programs? And that's really an area where we have focused, myself and a colleague of mine, Paula Collins, worked on some research to figure out what exactly does that mean? How would we advise our state clients in what a high quality program looks like for these kids?
Mm-hmm. And so you did a report, I guess one of the only reports that kind of gives us some guidance. And so are you saying that we're focused on group homes and residential treatment in terms of, because let's just statistically, kids in general, not, I don't know about traffic kids specific, I'll ask you, but kids in general do well if we they can stay at home and we can bring services in. If that's not possible, they do well in a foster care setting with kinfolk. It's just, you know, and then if we can't do that, a foster care setting in someone's home, if that's not possible, a group home. And if that's not possible, some kind of residential institutional kind of thing. So, you know, as we're all running in saying, oh my God, trafficking is happening and I want to help these kids so bad and I want to open a group home. It's like, well, you should know that kids in homes have better outcomes, but we still need group homes and we still need residential care programs and things for those kids who just, it doesn't, foster care doesn't work well for them. So you're working on, or you've authored a report that focuses on group homes and residential kind of care. Is that right?
That's right.
And so what were some of your findings in terms of what are quality standards? What should people be doing?
Well, there's a couple of different ways to approach it. One is to adopt what the organization My Life, My Choice has called a universal precautions approach. And this is an approach that is designed particularly to focus on the prevention of trafficking for children who are in foster care. In that model, any group home or residential facility should have curriculum in place and training in place for the staff in how to use a trauma-informed approach to understand and prepare children for the possibility of being recruited into trafficking. And so there are several curriculums we reviewed and talked in depth with Lisa Goldblatt Grace from My Life, My Choice. They have a curriculum for those kinds of programs. And it has a lot of training, focus on trauma-informed care, but also the ability to assess the youth that are placed for whether they have experienced trafficking. And then recommends a set of support services for those youth so that they wouldn't necessarily have to move into a different type of facility, but they could receive the same kind of support services like peer mentoring and other program supports that a child who's placed in a foster family home could also receive. So that's the universal precautions model. And I think it's important to note in the context of Family First, because states are really looking for an ability to design programs that reach a large number of foster youth, because foster youth are at a high risk for trafficking. A large percentage of the kids who are trafficked come out of foster care or have spent time in group homes. The other kind of setting is the kind that's specially designed for children who have been assessed as needing a high level of care that's specifically related to their experience of trafficking. And so those kinds of standards are things like safety protocols, consideration of a child wanting their own room as opposed to sharing rooms. Cell phone policies is another thing that's really interesting to consider, whether or not the youth have access to their phones. The security of the setting, how do people get in, how does the child get out, and thinking around security with that. And probably the most expensive aspect to implement is a higher staffing ratio. generally tends to be recommended for these kinds of settings. So those are a few of the elements that might be a little bit different than a home that's not designed to meet those needs.
That's awesome. And so tell us a little bit about maybe Bethany, this impending deadline. What's up with this October 1st deadline?
Yeah. So as Sarah mentioned, the it was passed into law in 2018, and states had an option to delay implementation, and many states took the option to delay implementation. And so the clock is now ticking and getting up close to that deadline. And so of September 30th, where October 1st, everything, the game changes and everything goes into real live gear. And so what has been happening over the past couple of years, almost 3 years now, in terms of work around this is, I'll say starting with states that decided, some states are deciding to create new housing types for youth who are trafficked or at risk of trafficking. Some states already had those specialized residential settings and congregate care settings, and some states did not. So, but many states had not yet defined what at risk of trafficking is from a child welfare perspective. So a lot of states were starting with developing definitions for who may be served in these populations. For the most part, the defined populations of those who have experienced sex trafficking are pretty standard and clear. A lot of states had to start from square one on defining at risk. And so that was a lot of, across states, that was a lot of conversations with existing community providers and partners, looking at analysis of how we've defined sex trafficking and what tools we're using. So some states are using risk tools where they can say this doesn't quite meet the threshold of trafficking. It is high risk. And so they're using those tools. So kind of all that to say that there's been a lot of work going into community meetings, meetings with existing providers, meetings with, in Florida, for instance, when we were implementing this, we have privatized care, foster care and placements in Florida. And so we had to meet with those privatized agencies on what needs do you need to be met out of this? What needs does child welfare in terms of the state agency need to have met out of this? And what needs do the youth and providers need to have met? So a lot of balance in that, in coming up with some of these definitions of these populations. And then moving, once we define the population, what are the standards of care we will need for these housings? And so, like Heather mentioned, for your specific housing type, for youth who have experienced trafficking, a lot of times you're looking at reduced staffing ratios. In Florida, for instance, for that specialized housing type, we have a 1-to-4 staffing ratio, which is much smaller than our standard group care staffing ratio. You have training and intensive training. So again, using Florida as an example, for these facilities, you have to have 24 hours additional training just on working with commercially sexually exploited youth, on top of all your other standard trainings for licensing. And then you will have additional programming set in place, which could vary from house to house, but there will need to probably be some standards around baseline programming offers. And as Heather was mentioning, some of the security and protection. So there's a lot, and that is just for the houses that are specifically serving youth at risk. You have additional conversations on what the standards will be for the housing type serving youth at risk of trafficking, those who have not yet experienced trafficking, and additional conversations on whether to co-house or not house, or whether to exclusively house. It's a really complex conversation, which is why we're still having these conversations and still wrapping up all of these details as we get to this October 1st deadline, where at which point the standards will have to be defined clearly, codified somewhere, and put in place, ready to go, and presented to for estate plan approval. And so all of that's got to be done for that funding for these housing types to continue to be received and there not be a gap in funding issue presented.
So in order to keep your funding or get funding, you have to meet the state level standards. And does the state get the choice, each state, do they get the choice to define what at risk means, to identify how many training hours Yes, everybody's saying yes, they do. And the ratios and the safety and security, those are all state driven, correct? And so are there, I know there's a national committee, I guess, that attends to this. You all are on it, I would imagine. Yes, no?
Well, there's not exactly a national committee that attends to it. There is, and I don't know if you're referring to the National Child Welfare Anti-Trafficking Collaborative or, and kind of how child welfare agencies are grappling across the nation with how to implement this. So yes, we are working on that through the collaborative as far as trying to help states who need resources and figuring out how to do that.
There's also the Children's Bureau through the Administration for Children and Families, which is where ideas can get bounced off of. I knew in the beginning of some of the implementations, we were saying, well, do you have any guidelines or guidance on possibly how to define at risk? And so there's, you know, some agencies at the federal level and support agencies like Casey and some of those other child welfare based agencies, public consulting group, who can come in and support and help on some of the questions you may have around implementation. And there's been a lot of back and forth on questions because it is such a shift fundamentally in the way that we are addressing child welfare to some extent.
And then do those people that might be involved on the national group, do we assume that they have some state level group that they are coming back to and sort of grappling with to come up with each of their state definitions?
Mm-hmm.
So how does one find out where to find this state level group and what the names of, if they can get involved or provide any information mm-hmm. to the state group?
I can talk about a little bit about what is happening in Minnesota as far as that goes. So like we've all kind of highlighted, it looks different everywhere, how they are implementing this. And because there's so many different things happening under Family First with the placement prevention services side, and then all of the very rigorous requirements for qualified residential treatment programs, and then also the development of these three specialized exception setting types. There's just a lot happening. And so to try and figure out, you know, I would say that in our experience, there's work going on in each of those areas that that folks could get involved with, right? When it comes to our state, we are one of the states that opted to wait until the end of the line to implement. We have a great tradition in Minnesota of really wanting to get as much input as possible before we make a decision on something. And so I would say, like for us specifically, we did go through the process that Bethany described, as far as took about a year of bringing together stakeholders and looking at research and talking to survivors and talking to all the people who are involved. Try and figure out, how do we define at-risk for sex trafficking in our state? What does that look like? And how would we implement that? So in fact, in the next couple of weeks, maybe by the time this podcast episode airs, we will finally have our definition of at-risk sex trafficking published in policy. And actually our standards that we're creating for these specialized setting types, these license certifications that we're creating, are still in our state legislature right now. So they haven't passed yet. And so we are really at the tail end of trying to implement this, hopefully by October 1st. But I guess one other thing that I wanted to talk about that is really relevant to kind of how do you decide how to structure this? Like, how do you decide how to define at risk? How do you decide what the standards should be? All these different issues that we've been talking about. There's a really complicated phenomenon. What is the impact of Family First going to be when it comes to the residential services side? So are we simply trying to basically recategorize all the kids who are currently in out-of-home placement so that they can continue to stay in out-of-home placement? And I'm putting that out there right out front, because pragmatically, that's the debate that people are having. Mm-hmm. And so by having these exception types where programs don't all have to necessarily meet these really high standards to be a qualified residential treatment program, but instead can fall into one of these exception types, there's a lot of dialogue going on back and forth of how broad do we want to define at risk for trafficking? How high should these standards be, or how low, right? How do we stick with the spirit of the law and serve the youth to the best of our ability, but have some kind of standards, right? As far as who is in and who is not in these specialized settings. Really complicated. The final thing I'll say about that before someone else jumps in is just that, you know, are we really serving new populations, identifying new kids who are not necessarily already in the system? Or are we just reframing and providing better training for staff so that they can kind of reframe many of the kids who are already in the system as being at risk for trafficking? So that's a lot to throw out there, but that's really kind of the nuance and the complication of trying to figure out how to implement family first at the state level.
Yeah. And can I add one quick thing to, you know, we're talking about how to define the population and what standards of care should be associated with and how are we going to fit it into make our existing systems work and function just under these new rules, essentially. And I will just, one of the key considerations in implementing this too is the assessment process. We will have the populations defined. We will have the housing types defined imminently. But what will the assessment process look? So are we going to implement that in a way where we're kind of having a very narrow approach and mindset and really trying to pin down, okay, you meet the definition of verified as having commercial sexual exploitation victimization, but further, are we looking for whether that child is an appropriate placement within this particular setting type? Because not all children who have experienced exploitation are. So, you know, are we just going to make this huge setting type that any child who is commercially sexually exploited automatically qualifies just based on that victimization? And we don't, or do we need to go beyond? We do need to go beyond and really have a comprehensive assessment around which children that are fit within this definition really will be an appropriate fit for this housing type. And the same for youth at risk of trafficking.
Yeah, it sounds so much like an ecological model, like you're looking at the person and what's the assessment of what's happened to them and their needs individualized. But then you're looking at the environment, like, okay, once we understand these risk factors or these experiences, what kind of environment, what kind of setting is conducive to them feeling safe, being safe, recovering, those types of things. So it's kind of seems like two different assessments. Heather, in your report, or as you were doing research, did you look at any of that, or are you pointing in any directions or at this point?
I think the biggest direction that we're trying to point in is to say the problem that Family First is presenting to states is changes to the rules and what the federal government will provide funding for. Mm-hmm. And so the state has to really look at how are we providing services? How do we measure whether what we're providing is actually impactful and making kids and families' lives better? And do any of the rules that are imposed by Family First help us achieve better outcomes for these kids? And instead of trying to figure out, some states really do need to figure out how to hold on to every federal dollar that they can because they just don't have enough money in their system. And those states may be taking approaches that are more focused on maintaining the federal funds by following as many of the rules for Family First as they can. you know, other states across the spectrum of the services and the programs that Family First impacts are able to take a broader view around what does my system need? Do we need specialized settings for victims of trafficking? Where do we need them? And what are the mechanisms that we can put in place to support providers so that they can meet those standards? Do we need programs in our group homes that can help to prevent future trafficking? And if we do, let's look at some of the programs that exist, raise those standards. And then what we really want states to do is then measure whether or not it's working. So if you do implement some of these new prevention programs, how are you going to determine whether or not it actually worked? So that you're not just trying to hold on to your federal funds, but you're actually using these new federal laws to make the programs and services that you're providing better. That's what we are trying to focus on. And that's why we put together the paper, because I'm not an expert in these services, and I didn't know what to tell my clients when it came to what the standards should be. As we started to look, we realized there's not a lot of research. The evidence base is very slim. And so we pulled together what exists. And also, from listening to your podcast, actually, I have found some additional research that exists that we need to incorporate and really sort of extend out what we know about what works. And then as Family First is implemented and we move forward, to evaluate and measure what actually does work and build the evidence.
That's awesome, because I know there's such a delicate balance. You could get lost in the details. States can be like, okay, you know, the group home or the residential care can be like, okay, here's what the state is imposing on us now. So let's just go jump through these hoops and figure out how to jump through these hoops so we can keep the funding and just, you know, dot the I and cross the T and keep doing basically what we were doing, but trying to meet these new standards. From people they might believe don't even know what they're talking about. And so, you know, you're running up against that, but trying to, you know, how will you, I guess, communicate to people that it's not just politicians kind of laying back on their laurels? Okay, I passed some stuff. I want to go out and run, tell the nation I passed some stuff, so they think that I'm doing something important. I remember, and I know it's important, but at the time I thought it was crazy, but we were doing a group home, or we were considering a group home. And one of the policies was, you know, you have to have a railing if you have any staircase that has more than four steps. And we were like, okay, like really? But, you know, but that's important because people will fall and they'll, you know, crack their head open or they'll go to the emergency room or whatever. But when you're trying to focus on the bigger picture and you have to run around your home and say how many you're counting stairs, you're like, okay, this is the state getting ridiculous about things they don't know anything about. So how will you communicate that this is something that's genuine? It was thought out. It was vetted by survivors and experts and people that came around the tables for hours and weeks and months to really be inclusive, to really get to people who are at risk and being trafficked. How will you communicate that down to the people who are trying to just do the good work without 555 different rules for me to do the work? How will that happen?
So for some of those that are existing providers, hopefully, and are just modifying, either becoming one of these exemption types or are something, hopefully they were a part of the conversations around formulating some of these definitions and some of these standards. For those that will be coming into it, I've gotten to meet with prospective group home or safe home, as we call them in Florida, provider after provider. And we often, right off the bat, hand over the licensing standards and the certification for safe houses specifically standards and all of this, so that there is an understanding that all of this does exist. So I think that really open and transparent early communication prior to a facility possibly being donated that won't be able to be restructured into an appropriately licensed home, or prior to steps being made that will not work out. Just having that conversation up front and being transparent about that. And I can't say I was a part of determining when railings should be instituted or not, but as far as some of the certification languages and reasons why we have certain extra requirements in place, I would hope that we would be able to communicate it as tools to help this person effectively serve the population that they don't have to come up with themselves. Now, we have a long way to go, as Heather mentioned, to evidence-based practices and to, you know, we on the standard side, we have some evolving to do and a lot of measuring of outcomes and evaluations to do. But of what we know right now, these are the standards that have been put in place to give the provider the tools they need to, once those doors are open, they are ready to go and effectively meet the needs of those that they're serving. So hopefully it'd be able to be communicated as support to them.
Mm-hmm. And what do you all say to somebody who says, I am very grassroots. I don't, I couldn't even tell you where the policies might be located, nor make meaning out of what they all say, but I have a lot of compassion and caring for kids, and I want to take care of children who are abused.
Well, I do get those phone calls sometimes. So I can say, you know, there's a lot of different responses that I could have to that. I think that I'll give you the general response, and then I'll give you the family first response. The first thing that I would say is that, yes, that is wonderful that you are compassionate and you want to help youth who have experienced trafficking or exploitation in your community. And there is such a need for you to get involved. I would say, though, that providing shelter, housing, residential care for kids who have been trafficked or exploited has a lot that goes into it. And there are people, at least in our state in Minnesota, who have really been working on developing this for more than a decade, who even still struggle, right, to figure out how do you really keep these kids safe? How do you provide the most supportive healing environment for them? And so I would say, if you're interested in providing that kind of care, why don't you get involved with a program that already is and learn from them? And then start small with maybe doing some mentoring, some services, supporting an organization that is already providing high quality services for children and families who experience trafficking, and start there. And then eventually, if you do end up finding a gap that is not being met in your community and you are interested in possibly applying for some funding to start a program, then come back and we'll get you next right. But see what's going on already to meet some of the needs so you really know how you can plug in. Then I would say, pertaining to Family First, there is kind of a paradigm shift going on. And so people are recognizing that more kids than they realize might actually be experiencing trafficking or be at risk for trafficking. And so I would say then, if you are compassionate and you want to get involved, I would say there's a lot of opportunity to help and to really prevent trafficking from happening, and to really work, recognize that most kids who are in the child welfare system, the juvenile justice system, who are in foster care, are kids who are at risk for trafficking. So I would say getting plugged in and supporting those agencies in your community is a really, really important thing to do, because there's never enough services to go around.
So thank you all for being here. We're going to do one more session where we're going to drill down even further on this issue and talk more sort of on the ground level, so that people who are having group homes or foster care or child welfare workers, how they will be affected, and just get more specific about it so that people will know everything that they need to know from the federal level to the state on down to the community. So thank you all once again for your time. So the law was signed into law in 2018, January. We were just saying offline how you had the option to wait. And I think almost every state took the option to wait. But at least in the spirit of the law, they're really trying to help children in communities to stay in their home or have quality programming.
Yeah. And from what I understood about what they said, they take the federal money like Title IV-E that we talked a little bit about last week, and they kind of changed the way that's being used.
Yeah. So now it can be used for prevention services, where before it can only be used for out-of-home placements. Now it can also be used to prevent out-of-home placements.
See, and that makes so much sense. And the government making sense, doesn't always happen.
Exactly. It makes it harder to really put kids in group homes, and it provides a higher quality of services to youth because people will have to be better trained. So, and, you know, people don't always like that because they just see these laws and policies are just more hoops that they have to jump through. But I hope it's going to turn out really good.
Yeah, me too. And then you talked about the continuum of care being correlated with poor long-term outcomes. So the further away a kid gets from their home life setting, the worse, or potentially the worse their outcome.
Right. Generally speaking, that statistically, kids that have been abused, for instance, generally, you know, if they come into the system on one medication, for example, if they go into residential care or they're removed from their home for a very long time, you know, they can come out on 4 medications. It's just, it isn't home. No matter what, you know, being home is the best, but kids can't always stay home because it's too dangerous and they're too much at risk. So they might have to go to a group home or, you know, even further to a residential setting. So the further they get away, you know, if you can hang the cutest curtains and you can try to make it as homey as possible, it just statistically, kids don't generally come out with better outcomes.
Right. And, you know, the law lacks details on specifically how to treat children who have been trafficked or are at risk for being trafficked. So it seems like the states are still trying to figure that out.
Exactly. So Heather did an awesome report on what high quality programs look like. And they also talked about the My Life, My Choice program, which is a really good program. It's been around for a number of years and survivors are involved in implementing the curriculum. I just want to say, I also have a curriculum. We spent about 3 years developing the curriculum. It's called the Best Life Human Trafficking Prevention Curriculum for At-Risk Girls. So it's for girls 12 to 17 years old. And they're really, after 3 years of studying this, there are about 9 elements that need to be present in a good prevention curriculum. So I train people to implement that curriculum. And I think I'm going to do a solo podcast really on prevention curricula and what to look for and how to implement best practices. And then I have a tool as well that helps people decipher, you know, determine what a good program is. So I think I'm going to dust that off and maybe give that out again for free. And I really love to spend a lot of time talking about prevention because I love it. I know a lot about it, but I'm going to save that for another day and not take away one more moment of this awesome content with these 3 powerful women.
Okay. But I think it sounds good. I love the idea.
Yeah. And I love the way they broke it down this week and made it pretty clear. Although no one knows what most states will end up doing in the end or what exactly will be the outcome, but rest assured that everybody's meeting and the best minds are at the table, or we hope they are, but at least Sarah, Bethany, and Heather are at the table. So that's really good. So we'll be back next week to find out how those states that have their plans together, how well they're doing or what they might be doing, do some maybe guessing on what the outcomes might be, because they have an October deadline really to tell the people in their states what they'll be doing. So I hope in the end, it just the outcome will be better trained advocates and caregivers that are providing good housing and services to trafficked youth and those at risk. So we'll be back next week to drill down even more so that it becomes relevant to people who actually want to offer foster care and housing and group homes to survivors. So we'll be back next week to finish the three-part series.
Let's not just do something, let's do the best thing. If you like this episode of Emancipation Nation, please subscribe and I'll send you the weekly podcast. Until then, the fight continues.